Nipun Mehta, welcome to the new school.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I was sharing with you just before we began to record that I spent the last hour looking at your website, charityfocus.org, and I had the really unusual experience for me that I was so blown away by what you've done that I went into a quite altered state of mind, and usually I'm very focused before these conversations on the questions I'm going to ask and how the interview will go. But I found myself just sitting in my chair, just with a sense of wonder about what you have accomplished and created, which I think is quite unique in my experience of the internet. I just wondered, what is your experience of the work you're doing in terms of what you call the invisible revolution of the internet? What do you mean by that?
Well, I really find, well, thank you, Michael, for those kind words. I would add one correction in the sense that I don't feel that this is sort of my accomplishment or even our accomplishment. It's almost a birthing that happens in its own self-organized ways, and we all get to be instruments in that. But I do think that the internet has created a new dimension of organizing, a sort of new possibility that previously wasn't there. And I feel like it's in response to our sort of collective conscious rising to new levels. And in that sense, the invisible revolution, I mean, the invisible matrix that connects us all, sages have been talking about it for ages. So many people experience it consciously and probably unconsciously. Everybody experiences it. And so it's really the question is how we can be more in alignment with that invisible matrix. And I think what the internet does is creates organizational paradigms that bring us more in harmony with those subtler underlying currents of life that make us all alive.
You speak of a collective conscious rising to new levels. Are you suggesting that there is the possibility that humanity as a whole can move toward a consciousness where we might resolve some of the terrible crises that we face today?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I feel that almost all the time, all the problems that we experience and encounter are really an invitation to reach newer heights of that collective consciousness. And I feel that in that sense, every problem, every sense of suffering is a gift and a calling to deepen our awareness.
I forget who it was, but someone once spoke of the internet as the exoskeleton of a collective human consciousness. I think thinking in terms of Teilhard de Chardin's understanding of the movement of human consciousness forward. What is your sense of the internet, the web as a whole, in terms of its impact on human consciousness? Clearly, it's being used for many darker purposes, and then there is this possibility that it contributes to the rise in consciousness. How do you appraise its effect on human consciousness as a whole?
I feel like it's a tool. It's a tool, and like all tools, it's going to be, it can be used in good ways, and it can be used in not so good ways. And really, the revolution has to happen within the human heart, within our minds. And I think until we do that, we're going to have problems, no matter what the tools. But I think that the internet really is in its infancy right now. And because it's in its infancy, you have this potential to really leverage its positive traits, so to say, to spin it in certain directions, which may not be open, once it matures. So just as a child's mind, Zen mind, beginner's mind, just as a child's mind is so open, and hence, absolutely anything is possible, I think in that sense, the internet provides us that window at this moment in time. I think 10 years down the road, it's going to be a different ballgame. And I think that maybe, 200 years down the road, we'll have other tools where these possibilities are there to sort of catapult our consciousness and deepen our generosity in deep ways. So I don't see it as a, I don't think internet's going to solve all the problems. I don't think, that it's, this is it. This is the one time in all of eternity that this is possible. But I do think it's a special time. I think, and we can, and ought to take advantage of this, and save ourselves some suffering.
I'd like to turn to your work with Charity Focus, which you started in April 1999 with three friends. Tell us a little about Charity Focus.
Charity Focus, like all good things in life, I don't think I can define it. It's at a very loose level. It's an experiment in generosity. I mean, the idea was, can we just give without any strings attached? And that was it. None of us had ever run an organization. None of us had ever given a talk. None of us knew how to, file for a 501c3 status. We didn't even have an organizational name. We just said we want to help. And I got a bunch of my friends together, and I said, let's go out and do something good. And we ended up going to a homeless shelter in San Jose. And we go in and we said, we're here to help, what can we do? And after a while, we ended up building a website for them, because that was something that was in our sort of domain. We were in the Silicon Valley and we had those skills. And, at that time, 1999, nonprofits were far from being on the internet or even understanding its powers. We actually had a brochure back then, Michael. It's really funny, because we had a brochure that was meant to be for nonprofits to convince them to try to leverage the internet. Until we went through the list, and of course now the scene is entirely different. But we started in that way, and then our whole idea was that we just want to give, and this is one manifestation that seems to work. And we started by building websites for nonprofits in the Silicon Valley. And we set the price, and we said the price is going to be zero. We're not going to ask for anything in return. And it was fantastic, the response. I mean, people, I feel that people inevitably, time and time again, will just respond to generosity. Pure, authentic, raw generosity will inevitably elicit a response. And it did. Certainly, that's been our experience in the Silicon Valley in April 99 and ever since. But back then, we had lots of volunteers that said, yeah, sign me up. I'm ready to give without any strings attached. And people were surprised, because that was, what you read in the papers was, hey, you got to get your, big car and big house and next promotion and get your $1 million and whatnot. But this was a different response. This was about engaging the creativity and the enthusiasm and the energy of the Silicon Valley in a different direction. And because our price was right, nonprofits were more than happy to raise their hands and say, yeah, we need help too. And so that's sort of how it began, very serendipitously. We had no intention of growing an organization. We didn't even know what was going to be the name of it at the time, and we just kind of responded to everything as it happened.
And today, can you describe Charity Focus?
It's just as hard to describe it today, but what ended up happening over the years is that I often tell a lot of people that, if we were in the 1800s, we would do farming. And we would be like these nice guy farmers. But in this context, in this time and space, what ended up happening was that all our principles, we had three principles to start with, and those were really, this power of being volunteer-run, not asking for anything, and just trusting and doing small things. And those three principles are crucial to any model of scale on the internet, and we just kind of happened upon it just because of our alignment with our spiritual values, and it seemed to work. So as a result, our manifestations kept growing. We had lots and lots of volunteers, and it was coming, by the thousands and by the tens of thousands. And we started to do different things. We started to run different portals. So we used to do websites for nonprofits that sort of went into web solutions for nonprofits. Then we went into web services, sort of web portals, which would provide thematic services for the whole world. And these included, you know, one of the first examples of that was, there was a .com by the name of PledgePage, and they allowed runners who were, and you know, fundraisers who were trying to raise money for good causes, and they allowed them to put their photos and diaries and message boards and guest books and whatever, you know, all the good stuff about who they are and why they're running this cause. They allowed them to put it online and sort of, so you can spread it through the internet and email. And they were going to close. They were a for-profit company, one of these dot-coms, and they were providing a great service, but they were just going to shut down because there was, you know, they couldn't sustain themselves. And so we went in and we said, you know, let's do something radical, you know, let's take it on. And so here was a .org, you know, this is what the headlines of the newspapers were, pretty crazy, because it's like a .org with no money takes on a .com that was trying to make millions. There is some poeticness to it. But what ended up happening surprised all of us. We didn't really know how strong our infrastructure was, but we took this portal on, and we doubled all their numbers in 3 months. And you know, we made everything free, and that attracted a lot of people, and we were just able to scale up. And so we said, wow, you know, maybe we're on to something. And so that was sort of our entry into different portals. And now we run, you know, all kinds of portals, from a daily good news site to a video portal to, you know, a kindness portal that promotes sort of, that uses smile cards to promote kindness in the world. And we have a conversations.org, which is a gift economy print magazine, and the list goes on. So there's just a whole bunch of different projects. But all of them have the same theme. You know, it's, the idea is to be the change you wish to see in the world. And, yeah, I think Gandhi put it so well.
And when I went to the website, I found it organized under three headings: inspiration, volunteers, and nonprofits. And under inspiration, there was Daily Good, which is a service that gives you the good news of each day, a bit of good news each day. Under, that's one of them. And then under volunteers, you mentioned the smile cards. Describe the smile cards and how they work.
Oh, I love smile cards, Michael. Thanks for asking me that question. It was fantastic. I was talking with one of my cousins, who's a really cool guy, and you know, has his own band and whatnot. And we were talking about college pranks, and we started breaking down, you know, the intentions of why people do these pranks. You know, whether it's from, you know, it's creative, it's collaborative, it's challenging, it's fun, but at the end of the day, it's largely destructive. And so I asked him, you know, I said, do you think we can do something constructive that has all those same elements in them? And we came up with this idea of smile cards. And the whole, you know, the whole concept is that you do an act of kindness for somebody, and anonymously, because that's the hardest thing to do, and you leave a smile card behind. So let's say you're paying toll. First guy, you're paying your toll, and you can pay $3 extra and pay toll for the guy behind you. And when the guy comes to the window, he gets a smile card and says, "Hey, somebody's paid for your toll as an act of kindness, and now you go and pay it forward." And so that's the project. And we did a couple of radical things with that because we're so rooted in sort of this gift economy idea and just kind of infinite trust in generosity. I don't know how else to express it, but it's just this deep, deep trust. We do radical things, and you know, some of them, people look at it and say, yeah, I don't know how that's going to survive, you know, but it does because it's rooted in generosity. So similarly with this helpothers.org site, which is the home of smile cards, we did a couple of things. One was we said that, you know, we would try to keep it completely brandless online. So when you go to About Us, you know, it says we are you. I mean, there's no people or there's no we are running this or this is our plan or this is our agenda. It's just us. And so that was cool. And certainly, you know, there are bounds. So when people donate X amount of money, then they have to find out who is the organization behind it. But by and large, we don't, you know, there's no identity on the site. But second thing was that if somebody wanted cards, they could get it online. They could download them and take it to their printers. But if they couldn't, they could order it online. And it was completely free. So you could be in Zambia, and you could order smile cards, and you'll get them next week. And there's no cost.
Oh, that's just wonderful. And you have a list on the site. You mentioned the toll booth, you know, paying the toll for the person behind you. And then you list favorite ideas like drop off a plant or flowers or an apple pie at the police department or order someone a dessert anonymously at a restaurant or take flowers to a hospital ward and leave them for someone who hasn't had any visitors. So there's just a list of hundreds of other possibilities. And the experience of, for me, of going to the website and just immersing myself in one after another of these extraordinary ideas. Tell us a little about KarmaTube.
KarmaTube is another one of these things that sort of engages people in action. The internet is the first time that inspiration and action are on the same medium. So you have, usually you watch TV and you say, okay, tomorrow I got to wake up and I got to remember to look up what, you know, I saw a very inspiring ad and I got to look them up in the phone book or ask somebody or you pick up the phone call and call 411. Internet is the first medium where you can see something inspiring that moves you and boom, right away on the same platform you can have an action. And so we looked at this whole YouTube phenomenon. You know, YouTube is growing like crazy. I mean, I think they're getting, last year, in 2005, they were getting 10,000 views a day. 2006, they got about 100,000 views a day. And it's just like growing and growing like crazy. And so we looked at YouTube and you said, you know, anyone who takes a deep look at it says, well, there's just a lot of trash on it, you know, but there's a bunch of good stuff too. So the whole idea of KarmaTube was to feature videos, but couple them with three small actionable items that everybody can take. So you see something, you know, there was a video of this, I think, 80-year-old woman who had spent 30 years recycling aluminum cans. And she donated all of that to, you know, to build a community swimming pool.
Right, I saw that. Actually, she was on public television as well, she was featured on some major television program recently where I saw her as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Story, yeah.
And it's great because you look at that and you say, oh, I can, you know, I can recycle some cans, you know, you can, or you look at the free hugs video, which has been all over the internet, and you say, oh, yeah, I could go out and do something nice like that. It doesn't take any money, but it's a good thing to do, and it changes my mood and changes the mood of those around me.
Tell us the story of Johnny the Bagger.
That's the current video.
Right.
Johnny the Bagger, it's a great story. It's a true story of a kid with Down syndrome, and he goes to one of these customer service kind of pep rallies that they have at a grocery store. And, you know, the woman says everybody should try to put their heart into what they're doing, try to put your own signature, your own personalized message into whatever you're doing. And Johnny goes home, talks to his dad, and says, well, you know, I'm just a bagger. What can I do? And at some point, he has this idea. He's like, oh, I know what I could do. I'm going to write up a little thought or a little quote. And his dad helped him print it out. And every day, whenever he'd, you know, he'd take a whole stack of these, and when he's bagging them, he would put his thought of the week or thought of the day into this bag. And people would just leave, and they were so encouraged by it that, you know, people would come back and say, I want Johnny's thought. And at one point in this video, which I think is the most powerful moment of the video, you know, there's a huge line, and the manager says, hey, well, you know, we need more, you know, we need more cashiers, everybody just open up. And he opens up a bunch of these stands, and nobody leaves. Everybody wants to be in that line for this, you know, for the message of, you know, Johnny's message of the day. And it's really powerful how, you know, anyone in any position can really do something if their heart's in the right place.
You have another portal that you provide on conversations, interviews with social artists. These are conversations.org, hosts in-depth interviews of everyday heroes and a broad spectrum of artists. And I think in a earlier conversation we had, you were telling me about someone who goes to clean parks every day. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Could you tell us that story?
Yeah, so conversations.org is the website, but the name of the magazine is Works and Conversations.
Right.
And there was the editor of the magazine, Richard, he was at a park and he saw this Filipino man sweeping. And his name was, as he later found out, Demetrio Brecerov. And he goes and he talks to him and he connects with him and he finds out that he is just a volunteer. He sweeps the park just as his sort of act of community service. And he's an artist, and he does these intricate wooden carvings. And he just leaves them in the park. I mean, the whole idea is to beautify the park. And these are really beautiful that you could definitely sell them. And there's photos of them, and it's obvious that, you know, these would have a pretty high price tag, but he just leaves them there. And so Richard at one point asks him, you know, in the interview, it says, so aren't you afraid that somebody will take these? And he says, no, I'm not. Actually, would you like one? You could take one home, too. And that kind of an attitude, you know, these are the sort of, I feel like, the hidden artists that aren't going to make the covers of all your traditional magazines and the traditional media. And I really feel that these... we need to celebrate these unsung heroes and everyday artists. And I think conversations.org attempts to do that.
I love the idea, the phrase, conversations, interviews with social artists. I love the concept of the social artist, someone who has made works of service into an art form.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is. I think there's a quote by Kumaraswamy that talks about, it says that, you know, artist isn't a special kind of a person. Every person is a special kind of an artist.
Mm-hmm. So, I just having given listeners a sense of the breadth and depth of Charity Focus, I'd like to turn a little bit to your story. You were born in India, is that right?
I was. Yeah.
What kind of family did you come from in India?
You know, we're a middle-class family in India. I was born in Ahmedabad, which is where Gandhi, for the large part, was settled in. And, it was a great upbringing. My parents are really, they're very grounded in values, but at the same time, very open. And that helped me, you know, they would set some bounds and then said, you know, you got to find your own answers. And that's probably been the biggest blessing of my life.
And you came to the United States when you were...
I was in seventh grade. I was probably about 12 or 13. And so I had my initial upbringing was in India. I used to say half of my life in India, half here, but that's no longer the case.
What were your first impressions of the United States when you came here? What was it like to arrive in the United States for you?
I think, you know, anyone who arrives in middle school It's a difficult time. I mean, that's when people are, all the other students are finding themselves, and they're trying to explore life in so many ways. And being from an entirely different culture is a difficult transition, no doubt. So at that level, it was difficult. Maybe difficult is too strong a word, but it certainly had its major challenges.
You came in seventh grade?
I came in seventh grade, yeah. I was in middle school.
So what were you like as an eighth grader?
I was, that's a hard question to really try to pin down. I mean, I don't know how I define myself. I was always, ever since I was a kid, I always asked the deeper questions of life. I mean, I was just interested in, I would read, texts from all different religions and really try to get at the core of, okay, so what exactly is happening? And I was also blessed, to have influences in my life that, just spontaneous occurrences that would happen. I would run into this sage or that nun or, somebody who had a lot of wisdom, and they ended up guiding me at that right point in the right place.
Give us an example of that.
So many examples. I can tell you the first time four of us, my brother and my parents, we went back to India. I must have been maybe 14 or 15 at the time. We decided to take a trip back to India. And on the plane, on the stopover in Japan, before you get to India, we saw this guy at the airport. And he had a musical instrument. He was an old man with a beard, Japanese man. And he there seemed to be a lot of people around him. My mom sort of noticed him. He was like, oh, that seems like, it seems like somebody who is important or significant in this culture. And so we had no idea, but we just sort of noticed that. And then we sat down, and, we had there were three seats, and so my parents were in the back two seats, my brother and I in the front two, and there was a third seat next to my brother and I. And this man comes up, and he's, he's an old Japanese man, and just very radiant, very compassionate. And he just looks at us, and he's just looking at us, and he's looking at us, and I said, we were kind of confused. We said, why is this man looking at us? And so he was smiling. And so after about 20 awkward seconds, I said, can I help you put your instrument up on the top? And he says, yes, yes. And so I did. I helped him. And he sat next to us. And over the next several hours, I mean, he basically rocked our world in so many unthinkable ways. I mean, he just, all the things you assume about life, those are just not true for him. I mean, he could see things, he could tell about people, he could, he said it was planned that we're going to be on the same, on the seats next to each other, and so on, And I don't know how much wisdom there was or how much of it was eternal or not, but that point, it definitely rocked our world. And and you look at that and you say, yeah, that was cool. It forced me to think way out of the box and said, well, I've just met a man for whom such and such rules don't apply. And so what's really going on? And then I would investigate. And as I found that as I find a couple of answers, then more questions would sort of pop up by themselves, or more things perhaps that were always there, it start surfacing, and I start to see them.
So you've really been on a somewhat conscious, increasingly conscious, spiritual journey since childhood.
I would say so, yeah.
That's unusual. Most people don't get there until they're at least teens or 20s or 30s.
But I think it became more conscious as I got older. I mean, I was, I wanted to be a tennis pro when I was in my high school and college years, and then I kind of went on this, I was put on this default path of making more and more money and succeeding in the professional realm. And I had, I had to unlearn a lot of the things that I learned, and perhaps part of me is still unlearning that, so unpacking the bags.
But you write in your one of your websites that you say, I believe in going all out. I was a junior in college at 17, but finally graduated at 21 after taking some years off to play tennis. At 11, I roller skated my heart out to be second in the country. As an unrated player, I once beat a Russian master in chess. On my first day on the ski slopes, I went down a black diamond slope. So you're clearly somebody who sort of goes for it in whatever dimension of life you happen to find yourself.
I do. I like to push bounds, and I am so lucky that I think I've finally hit upon the right challenge, and which is the challenge of who really am I. As you know, you can take that attitude of go all out in all kinds of different directions, and I feel fortunate to have channeled that sort of energy that I seem to have within me in the direction of self-understanding and generosity and growth.
In the segment of your website on frequently asked questions, the question is, what do you think about most? And your answer is, death and service. Aren't you glad you asked the question? And I love that. And I wanted to ask you, what do you mean by that? What do you mean about death and service is what you think about most?
As macabre as it may sound, it's true. I really am rooted in impermanence, and I like to be rooted more and more so at even the deeper layers of my mind to be rooted in impermanence, and that's really a practice for me. I think a lot of times we tend to find security in permanent things. Oh, I've got this. I have this. I can hold on to this. And that tends to be our security and sort of our comfort zone. And over the years, I mean, I think I've realized that you can't really hold on to anything. I mean, everything's just going to change, and it's constantly changing. And so if you're really going to be a happy person, you need to be rooted in constant change. You need to be okay with things transitioning from one form to another. And to me, death was a very significant, it's a big thing. I mean, it's like, okay, at the end of the day, I'm going to be dead. This person that I call Nipun is no longer there. So what happens? And so that was always a question for me. And when I was 18, I used to volunteer at a hospice where, you know, those who were terminally ill would go. And you're assigned all kinds of people, from nurse to a spiritual counselor to, you know, a caretaker and whatnot. And there's also a volunteer. And I got to be, you know, I decided that I was going to be a volunteer at a hospice. I wanted to go and, like, you know, I wanted to go in the thick of things. And I said, let's go and, you know, serve people who are really having a hard time, who may be having a hard time transitioning out of their physical selves. And so I was a volunteer at a hospice, and I can tell you, Michael, I mean, it was pretty intense. You'd get to know a bunch of people, and 2 weeks later, you know, they call you and said, yeah, such and such has passed away.
How long did you do the hospice work?
I don't know exactly how long, but I want to say probably about 2 years.
Mm.
You have to get trained, and it takes, you know, there's a 6-month training period, and I was clearly the only 18-year-old in the room, you know, at any of their trainings. I mean, generally it's older people that would do it, and some people aren't really, you know, they don't want to deal with such kinds of things at that point in life, but I did. And
Can you describe an experience that you had in hospice that has stuck with you with an individual person?
Yeah. At one point, I was responsible for, you know, as a volunteer, I would go and get groceries for one of my sort of quote-unquote clients. His name was Mr. Ahern. I think he had fought in the wars, and he didn't have good relationships with his family, and so as he was dying, he's pretty much in the last stages. And there's none of his family members are there. But he had a nice house, he had a nice car, and he had, you know, he was able to afford a cook and all the kinds of amenities that one might need at that time. And I go in at one point, And I said to Mr. Ahern, you know, Mr. Ahern, I've put your groceries. I used to get him, you know, I used to get him whatever he wanted. And I've been a vegetarian my whole life, but he loved, you know, fish was the thing that he would always ask for. And so I would go to the stores and I'd go to a local Safeway and I said, you know, I don't know, here's this thing called Halibut, you know, can you like get me, can you, that's what my friend wants, and I'm just with him and he's on, you know, he's with the hospice and whatnot. And the people behind the counter would get excited and they'd give me like the best fish, you know. Mm. And Mr. Ahern would be so excited. He's like, I don't know what you've done, but like the food that you give me, I mean, I've never had such food in my life, you know, such fish in my life. And so one of those times I go in to put the groceries and I said, you know, Mr. Ahern, I've left him here. I'll see you tomorrow. I've got a lot, you know, I had a lot going on that day. And so I just wanted to do a quick drop in and drop off. And he calls me from inside, and he says, Nipun, you know, can you come in? And I did. I went in, and you know, you have to imagine this man. He had tubes going inside of him. He was very much in the last stages of his life as Mr. Ahern, and he calls me in, and he starts talking to me. And he's, you know, he says a few things, and then every like 2 minutes or so, he'd take a huge deep breath, and he'd start talking again. And he starts talking about something entirely different. He starts talking about some random topic that has come in his mind, and he's just talking and talking and talking, and he is at this point not coherent at all. But he doesn't want me to leave, so he just keeps talking. He just keeps talking. He's afraid. He's scared of what's coming next, and he really just wants to hang on to any bit of permanence that's there. And in that moment, I was that, and he did not want to let me go. And his expression of that was just talking and talking and talking. And I had to go, and at some point, I said, look, forget it. You know, what you have to do is not really all that important. You need to be here for this guy. And that was probably about 10 minutes into his, you know, talking that I realized that I said that. And you won't believe it, Michael. I was there for 3 hours.
Wow.
And I just sat there listening to him and wishing him compassion.
Mm.
And I didn't even understand all, you know, what does all any of that mean. I was just there with him. 2 days later, he passed away.
Mm.
And that, as an 18-year-old, you know, a couple of years later, I would go and, you know, get my first sort of real job. And when you sign this application, they tell you how much, what percentage of your thing would you like to put in your 401k, you know. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm 21 and you're telling me to plan for when I'm 65. I mean, who the heck even knows if I'm going to be around? And so in little ways, like these kinds of deep insights and experiences with the impermanence of life, you know. I mean, death is almost a negative word, perhaps. But with this kind of connection, I think if we keep that connection, we do the little things differently, and as a result, by the end of 10 years, you're just in a completely different space.
That's a beautiful story. As you know, right now, actually, I'm in the middle of the 134th Cancer Help Program here at Commonweal. We have 8 participants. Over the last 22 years, we've done 134 of these weeks. And so the experiences with people who are close to the edge is something that I'm familiar with myself.
Mm.
There are so many pieces to your story that I want to touch on, but in your biography on the web, you say, my 17th year transformed me in ways I can't describe in a sentence. What happened when you were 17 that transformed your life?
That's a complicated question. I would say that was a formative year in many ways. That was the year that, you know, I decided to I've always been pushing bounds, but that was the year I pushed my bounds in sort of an academic and athletic way. I took 40 units, semester units, at this junior college where I was, and I was there primarily to play tennis. It was pretty intense, and I also had this, you know, underlying spiritual journey that's always been there, but I think it was the 17th year that brought that into focus. I had a lot of experiences with myself, ultimately myself, but also with the community and life around me that taught me many things, and I was able to sort of transition from that, and I could easily see, you know, if I wasn't lucky, or if I don't know if luck is the right word, but I could have easily rotated in those conditions for, you know, decades in one way, shape, or form or another. And I really felt like I experienced a lot in that year, and I was able to, you know, say, okay, I've done that, and that's not where my cup, you know, that's not my cup of tea. And that's
so
not where I'm
at. At that point,
going.
Did you have a sense of greater clarity about your direction?
In a way, you could say I'm still confused. You know, I don't know if I have a clear direction. My commitment is to try to walk through every door that opens and honor that. And so even at that time, you know, I would, even with my junior college buddies, I would go up and I would go in the empty classrooms and take a bunch of them, and I would really try to figure out what life is, and say, look, you know, if you take this and you take this, and I sort of had this analytical view in my own naivete, that drive of trying to find out what's underneath all this was always there in me. And I think it came into clearer focus, but I think I sort of, there were probably a couple of roads that I could have taken, and I think my 17th year was one of those pivotal moments where I decided to take a road that was, that to me was a little bit scarier, but a little bit more authentic also.
In 2004, in June, you married Guri, on the first day of the seventh month, the day after Guru Purnima. You participated in an interfaith blessing ceremony in 9 faiths, including atheist, at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, where you publicly shared your vows. And the vows are so beautiful. Let me just describe a couple of them. Do you, Nipun and Guri, pledge to help each other in developing your hearts and minds, cultivating compassion, generosity, ethics, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom as you age and undergo the various ups and downs of life, and to transform them into the path of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity? Do you pledge to grow in Dharma? And then a series of others that end, do you pledge to reinforce and complement each other's virtue? Do you pledge to trust the inexplicable ways of the universe? Do you pledge to be an instrument of selfless service? Do you pledge to be real in all situations? Do you pledge to cultivate gratitude for the boundless gifts you have received? Do you pledge to expand your family to include all living beings? And you write of Guri someone who has been your inspiration for a long time. Could you tell us a little about Guri and how she has inspired you?
Yeah. Guri has been, I've known Guri for a long time. By long, I mean, you know, I'd known her well before we decided to get married, probably 8 or 9 years before that. It was never clear to both of us, because both of us have this strong sort of a monastic inclination almost. It was never clear that we were going to get married. And one fine day it was clear, and we just, you know, we said we're going to do it, and we did it that month. Guri has been there for, she's almost, you know, it's like this, I always think of a triangle. when I think of the relationship between Guri and I and how deep it is, you know, if you look at a triangle, or you look at a mountain, if you think visualize a mountain, you can, you know, somebody could be walking up to the top of the mountain from the east, and somebody else could be walking up to the top of the mountain from the west. And at some point, if you know that you are going to meet, you know, your friend on the other side at the top, that you keep going on your journey, and that as you walk in your own path towards the top, towards that one point, towards that, you know, complete unity, as you walk towards that and the other person is walking towards that, you're actually a lot closer to each other, even physically, you know, in so many ways. And so that metaphor has always really rung true of, you know, both people. You can walk along the base and you can say, okay, we're coming closer to each other. And that's one form of closeness. But I think if you start walking towards the top from two different sides and just know and trust that if it's that same one point you're going to, you're really coming closer to each other by walking your own independent paths. Mm. And that to me really encapsulates the relationship I have with Guri. It's been, you know, she's one of the, Guri and my brother, I always say, are like two of my sort of guiding lights, or two of my, you know, the foundation on which I stand in so many ways. Guri has provided a lot. She was there when she was one of the three people that was there when we did the first charity focus project. Uh-huh. She was there when we launched the smile cards. She was there when we did these, you know, we started these Wednesday gatherings at my place, at my parents' house in Santa Clara. And that's been going on, and there's thousands of people that have come through, unorganized, unbranded, just, you know, just the house and people coming in to share some time of silence and reflection. And she's been there, you know, for so many things that I feel like we've grown together, and in our own ways. You know, certainly we don't have any, you know, we're not like wedded to each other and like we do exactly the same thing that the other person does. It's very powerful to have that kind of a partner in service, to have that kind of a mirror that will reflect honestly and sincerely what is your own deepest understanding and your own deepest confusions. And to have that is a really beautiful thing. I feel very, very grateful to have her in my life.
Mm-hmm. I have my wife, Cheryl Patton, and I have a similar experience together, and I know how powerful that can be in one's life. 6 months after your marriage, you left home to journey to India and to travel by foot, living on $1 a day, eating wherever food is offered, sleeping wherever a flat surface is found. Ours was an unscripted spiritual pilgrimage to greet life in the farthest corners of our own consciousness. Tell us about that pilgrimage.
That, I think, in a way, is emblematic of our relationship. You know, we were crazy people, and we were very clear about why we wanted to get married. And it was not a deepening of attachment, but it was more of a, you know, deepening of our own awareness of who we are and supporting each other in that journey. And we really felt called to do it, and so we did it. But it's, you know, 6 months into our marriage, we decided to drop everything, and we sold all that we had and took a few boxes, left it at my parents' place, and said that, you know, let's Charity Focus at that time. The context was that Charity Focus at the time is doing great things, and although we don't deal with money, there's a lot of influence, you know, that comes when you're serving in so many ways. And so with this influence comes power, and power tends to corrupt. And how do you know? You know, and so we said there's only one way to find out, and it's to, can you drop it all? Mm-hmm. And can you go to a place where nobody knows your name? Can you go to a place where you have no security of money? Can you go to a place where You know, there is so much uncertainty, and you are have to be comfortable with that. And uncertainty sometimes even in a threatening, ominous way. So are you comfortable with all of that? Are you comfortable that no business card is going to open any doors for you? And what would happen, I mean, when you're tested in that deep way, are you still going to stick true to your values of compassion? Are you still going to talk about service? Are you still, you know, when you're hungry, can you still think of benefiting humanity? You know, are you still going to be on, you know, talking about compassion when you are threatened yourself? I mean, those were some of the questions, and so we said, let's do it. And we took a one-way ticket, and we, you know, my parents had to convince our parents. That took a little bit to do something crazy like that, but it was in the spirit of deepening our trust. So we took a one-way ticket, went to India, went to the Gandhi Ashram because we were inspired by Gandhi, and said we're going to walk south.
And what was it like for you to come back to India? Had you traveled to India on numerous occasions in between coming as a child to the United States, or had you been pretty much immersed in the United States in the interim?
Oh, I definitely taken some trips back, but this is a different kind of a trip that I think even if you're living in India, you don't get to know India in this way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have... And especially when you go back from here, there's a tourist kind of a trip, and then there's a, you know, adventure kind of a trip. But this was a pilgrimage, and that's very, very different in terms of what you are ready to see and in terms of what life shows you.
You write, before we started our pilgrimage, a group of kids once asked me the purpose of our trip. Rather spontaneously, I told them that my purpose is to move from the ego plan to the divine plan. And then you write a little later, my purpose in life then is clear. This is on your blog from the trip, after 1,000 kilometers of walking. You write, my purpose in life then is clear, to be an instrument of nature. Until I purify my heart to become that instrument, I will be grateful if I have an opportunity to serve. But it is only after that blossoming of awareness, if what the sages say is true, I will truly serve. So it was 1,000 kilometers on foot?
It was. And then we ended up at a monastery, and we flipped a coin. We said, is the journey inside or outside? And we flipped the coin, and the coin said, stay. And so we were largely meditating for the next 3 months.
And could you give us one story of an encounter that you had on that journey that touched you both particularly?
There were many. Almost every day seemed like an encounter of sorts. But there's, I'll talk about a time when so it was really hot. You have to visualize this scene. Where it's, you know, probably about 43 degrees centigrade. And you're walking, and you're walking through some of the hills, and you may or may not, you know, you don't know where your food is going to come from. You don't know where you're going to sleep that night. And because it's so hot, generally you leave at like 4 or 5 a.m., and then you stop around 11. And if needed, you can walk later in the evening as well. And so one of those days we're walking, and it's a very sparse area, a very rural area, and we're just walking. It's hot. I have a bandana on my head, and we both have, you know, backpacks with a few of our essentials, and my knee starts to hurt, and it feels like it's really busted, and it's every time I take a step, it starts aching. And so Guri brings out something, and, you know, one of these ointments, and we put it on, and I take my bandana off, and I wrap my thing around my knee, and we're walking, and still it's hurting. I mean, you know, that was no solution, so we're still going on. And at one point, you know, I have this realization that, look, forget it. You know, you got to be clear. You know why you're doing this, and you got to stay firm in that. This is when, you know, this is that moment when you're either going to break down or break through. and you got a breakthrough. Here it is. Just be still. Be with it. Everything comes and goes. Just be with it. And I was, you know, as I was thinking this, you know, my sort of back went upright, and I started walking in a really confident poise, sort of a manner. And right then, like, this guy comes out of nowhere. And, I mean, not out of nowhere, he's from there, but he just, you know, we just see a guy come up on this sparse road, and he says, can I host you for the day? It was a very odd question for somebody to just ask that right off the bat, you know, and we were like, yeah, we have no idea where we're going to stay, you know, we said we were trying not to be too eager, you know, we said, yeah, you know, if that works for you, we would be happy to come to your place. And he says, yeah, but I have to tell you that I'm really poor, and, you know, I don't have any electricity in my house, and I don't have any running water. We're on sort of hand to mouth every day. Kind of, he explained this whole situation, and I looked at him, and he had no idea what kind of a pilgrimage we were on, and he had no idea that my knee was busted, and I look at him with genuine compassion and so much compassion, you know, and I said, my brother, I would be happy to come to your house. And we ended up, we walked another couple kilometers through all the different fields, and he knew all the shortcuts, and we ended up at his hut, and it was awesome, because he says, you know, right as we go in, you know, his view is everything is God, and everything is a reflection of God, and, you know, his view was that here God had sent these people to our house. And so he tells his wife, right as we come in, he's like, hey, we, you know, God has come to our doors, and we need to, you know, we need to make some food. And so she goes out the back, and at that time I didn't understand. And she goes out, and she goes out to borrow food. Mm. And they bring us, you know, they bring us some food. And, I mean, well, it was pretty obvious what was happening at that point. And three of us sat down, and his wife was serving. And she'd even made, like, a small sweet dish. I mean, they really were trying to see. I mean, these were people just out of nowhere, just trying to see the divine in everything, you know. And there was some sweet that was in my plate. And I, you know, I tend to love sweets. And I try to tease Guri that I don't have a sweet tooth, but Guri's always telling me that I do. And, you know, when you're on a walk like this, you don't get anything you want. You get whatever is coming, you know. And so here was something sweet. At least it looked sweet. And I immediately, instead of eating everything else, as hungry as I was, I said, okay, I'm going to go for that first. And so I start eating it. And I realized that it didn't have sugar. Mm. And I still ate it. I ate it, and I loved it, and by the time it went to, you know, Udeshi Daka, who is the gentleman who saw us on the street, he had his whole meal, and then he had the dessert at the end, and he looks to his wife, and, like, with almost tears in his eyes, he says, you didn't put sugar, and, you know, they couldn't afford sugar, and that's why they couldn't put it, and he says, you go and borrow some sugar. And they fed us in this way, and you don't even know how to respond to that. You know, I mean, that is, like, so much gratitude that you cannot eat. When you have had one meal in that way, you simply cannot, all the meals for the rest of your life will be changed. I mean, it's just, you cannot have another meal without feeling gratitude. And so what they gave us was an incredible, incredible gift. And, you know, to make a long story short, the next day we ended up at another school, and there were a bunch of thugs, and we ended up, you know, trying to convince, we convinced the thugs to try to channel their thug sort of energy into goodness in the world. And they said, by the end of it, they were like, all right, you tell us what do you want us to do, you know, and how should we do it? And they just were lacking ideas, and they wanted to channel their sort of energy in this direction after hearing some stories. And so I said, look, there's this guy. His name is Udeshi, and he lives somewhere in the villages down there. You'll just have to find out, because by asking, and they're all sort of farm boys. And they were like, oh, no, Nipun, we got it. And I said, you got to go and find them a bag of sugar, all this food, and anonymously drop it off at his doorstep. And they were like, oh, we're on it, And that was incredible, So one day after another, when you live in this way, I mean, it just really transforms you at the core of your being.
Nipun Mehta, thank you so much for your work, for deeply inspiring me, for perhaps changing my life a little bit and changing the lives of so many other people. Your work is a blessing, and we are in your debt.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be having this opportunity to be of service.
Wow, that was wonderful. So I just welcome all of you to the conversation now. Anything you'd like to say or ask Nipun would be welcome. Can anybody hear us?
I can hear you. It's Barbara. It's just very hard to talk.
Right, I know. I had the same problem, Barbara.
You did great, Michael. It's just unbelievable. Nipun,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
With all my heart, thank you.
No. Thank you, Barbara. It's awesome to have you realize as you walk along the journey that you can't do this alone,
Yeah.
And so it's really many wings that we all need.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for always being there.
Nipun, this is Mary, and I just, I'm so grateful I've been able to hear more of your stories and learn from them today. And I just am deeply touched by these stories and by the way that you walk your life. Thank you, Nipun.
Thank you, Marian.
Nipun, it's Karen, and I also really can't speak. I'm very moved, and I look forward to talking to you another time. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. When we were walking, people would send us notes and say, I'm going to say a prayer for you today. There was a Filipino guy. He just wrote to me, and he said, I'm in the Philippines right now, and I'm touched by something I read, and I'm just going to say a prayer. And at one level, and people would say, I'm sending my blessings, and I'm sending my goodwill, and I'm sending, I hope everything is okay. And at one level, you can, in our scientific sort of world, you can almost discount all of that. But I can tell you, having experienced it, that you absolutely cannot. I had made a deal with my mom, because my mom, as all moms, was very concerned and very, it's very hard. It's very difficult as a mom, so to let go of your kids in this direction, in this way, and still trust that deep down inside that it is the right thing. And I definitely went with her blessings. But before we went, I had told her, I said, Mommy, you're going to be on this pilgrimage with me, except that you're going to do it here.
Mm.
And my mom is just, she has fed thousands of people, and she's an amazing person. And she really was worried about how I'm going to get my food. And that was one of her biggest concerns. It's like, Nipun, you can't just trust with so much like that. How are you going to survive? How are you going to get the food? And I told her, I said, Mom, this is what I want you to do. Whenever you're worried about my food, I want you to go and feed somebody else and trust that that will get to me in some way, shape, or form.
Oh, how beautiful.
And you will not believe it. And I heard this secondhand that, my mom, on one of the days, she was just having a really hard time going through all the scenarios about me and Guri and what could be happening. And she decides that she remembers our little deal. And she goes and she decides to make this sort of a sweet dish. That's really hard to make. And you know, Wednesdays we have all these people over, and so she said, she decided that she's going to make it over, and I have this visualization of my mom where, you know, tears are streaming down, and she is just crying and rolling and rolling and rolling and cooking and making it for some other people, knowing that it's going to happen, you know, that it's going to go around in its own sorts of invisible ways. And so I look at that, you know, and the kind of work I do, you know, you look at, certainly this was true on the walk, but the kind of work I do, you can look at the ledgers, you know, and say, well, all right, you know, the organization's annual budget's $5,000 a year. Okay, you know, that can't be a real thing. And you can look at all the sort of, the, you know, daily, you know, the dozens of emails that we get across the projects of people saying, my life has changed, bless you, this came to me at the right time. And you can't, like, those just don't go on any ledger sheet that we know of, you know, that way that can be counted. But at the end of the day, you look back and you say, okay, how is all this possible? You know, how did you go to India and you walked and you drank the water that you're not supposed to drink? How can you run an organization that delivers all these, you know, services without any overhead? And how can, you know, how do the right things sort of happen at the right time? And yes, that's luck, but after it happens 100 times, you can't call it luck. You know, what is going on? And to me, it's these blessings, that when somebody's touched and when somebody shares something, you know, from their heart, that really adds up, and that's really that level of, I don't want to call it currency because it's not, because it's super abundant, but that is what keeps me going, and that is the secret behind, if you can want to call it that, that's the underlying juice.
Nippon, on the website again, under frequently asked questions, there's a question, do you have a spiritual teacher? And your answer is, yes, you. And that's a beautiful answer. I wanted to ask you, have there been specific traditions which, for you personally, have been particularly useful or powerful, either teachers or traditions, that have been particularly useful to you in your journey?
I would say, and so many that it's almost to a point, that's where I get to the you. I was raised a Hindu, by definition. My wife is a Sikh by definition. But really, and I've studied, you know, all kinds of scriptures. One of the most influential men, one of the most influential figures, in my life was my tennis coach early on in my life. He was a devout Christian. And we would sit there and talk and argue and disagree and whatnot, but at the end of the day, we just loved each other, and we both knew that we were functioning from the same space. And we're both trying to do the same things, you know. And so he really, you know, through the metaphor of tennis, you know, taught me a whole lot. In recent years, I've really been thankful to S.N. Goenka, whose 10-day Vipassana courses have been a real blessing for me, where you just have 10 days of no reading, writing, talking, and you're just with yourself practicing this ancient art of meditation, which is completely non-religious and rooted in your own sort of experience. And two people could go to the same retreat and get two entirely different things out of it. So it's not that, oh, this is going to solve the problems of the world, you know. But I think that for the time and space where I am at, that really has served a lot. And, you know, really the blessings from people. You know, when people say thank you, and when people say, you know, Godspeed, and when people say, great, good on you, mate, you know. That really is very crucial to my work. I feel that it really informs my spirituality and the surface work that I do in the world. So there's a great, I was giving a talk keynoting this conference, and you know, there were a whole bunch of youngsters there, hundreds, and at the end, a couple of them come up and they ask me this very question, you know, so who's your spiritual teacher? And they were all, it was a part of a Jain convention. So Jainism is one of the big religions of the world.
This was the day after your marriage, wasn't it?
This was, yeah. Right. You're familiar with the story. Yeah. So these guys, essentially, they, you know, they were like, well, you know, what, I had committed to it. So I said, okay, I would go. And I went, and I gave this talk, and then they said they wanted me to come back and do it again in the breaks. And so I went home, I asked Gary, I was like, yes, I know, but, you know, what can I do? And she's like, go for it. And so I go, and at the end of that talk, some people come up and say, you know, who's your spiritual teacher? And I said, you. And, you know, and they looked at me kind of like, okay, that's a nice answer. It's a good textbook answer, but really, who's your spiritual teacher? You know, it's like, and I could tell that the guy who asked that question, he kind of had this quizzical look, like, okay, you're just regurgitating something that you've, you know, read or something that's nice to say. And so a little bit into the conversation, I go down and I bow down and I touch his feet. And, you know, in the Indian tradition, I mean, that's a major taboo. I mean, usually you would never do that to a young person. And I went down straight on the ground and just bowed down. And I said, you are my teacher. And I honestly do see it as that. And the most amazing part of the story was that, you know, he was stunned. And we, you know, a few questions and a few more stories later, he comes up and he bows down to me and he walks out and says thank you and walks out. And that, you know, that mutual reverence, I think, for life, seeing everything as a reflection of a deep, deep part of you, is a big thing.
Yipun, one of the things we are very eager to do with the new school is to talk not only to older people like me, but also to younger people, like many of the people that you work with. And clearly, your way of being and message and work has touched people of all ages, but including a lot of younger people. When you look at people from your now advanced age of, what, 30?
31, yeah.
31. When you look at younger people from your now advanced age of 31 and you look at older people who are also drawn to the work, what do you find is touching the younger people that you know? What are the qualities of consciousness and interest in forms of service that seem particularly present in the younger people that you work with?
I think that so many times the younger people they're talked down to, you know, they're talked at rather than talked with. And I feel that's the biggest sort of strategic mistake. And if you really do see them, and my thing is that I actually do see them as me. And that is my view. I mean, then bowing down to them is no problem. It's not like a, you know, exceptional thing that I do. I mean, I would do it any time. So I really have that sort of view, and I've found that that works really well, to see them as sort of equals, to see them as co-creators of a shared life that we are doing. And that, in fact, is true at a very deep spiritual level as well. We are all co-creating. And so the tendencies, I mean, I think you need to make it cool to give and not frame giving in this context of, you know, oh, it's something you do when you have everything. It's something you do when you have extra money or extra time. But really try to redefine giving as sort of an attitude in life and make it cool so they can get that experience. And I think one other thing is, I think if people don't really learn by intellectualizing a lot of these topics. Like people, you can't, you know, what I would do is I would just give people, if there's a whole bunch of us gathered together after and they're everyone saying, yeah, I want to give, let's go out and do something, I'll just go take them out in the middle of the street and, okay, let's go pick up trash or go do something. And then that experience really speaks for itself, because ultimately I feel that we are disciples of our own experience. So really focusing on experiential sorts of lessons rather than intellectual. Intellectual's good, but I don't. Not intellectual, but intellectual can get preachy sometimes. So that's where I tend to feel that, you know, trying to be making it cool to give, making it experiential, and making it co-creative would probably be the three things that come to mind.
And which of the parts of your work in Charity Focus seem to draw the most energy from younger people?
I think the whole idea of Charity Focus itself is what drives people. I mean, when we say, look, we're gonna look selfishness in the face and we're gonna say, bring it on. I'm not gonna give in. And when you have people of, you know, the founder of Sony Entertainment Television saying, okay, you know, I want to give my whole organization to you, people say, oh, how did that happen? Now it's because we didn't, you know, compromise our values. When you have people subscribing to, you know, this Daily Good newsletter, and every day people get this newsletter, and they've been getting it for over a decade, so many of them. And there's 45,000 subscribers every day, and nobody has ever been pitched or solicited in any way. And there have been no ads in the whole, you know, in any of our emails. And so people look at that and say, okay, these guys really just trust. And it's hard to trust, so it's challenging. And so I think this whole idea of let's take down the selfishness. Let's break down the barriers, and let's take that up as a challenge. And Charity Focus as an institution is doing that, and I think that more than anything, you know, more than any of the individual programs, that trait of, you know, trying to be unconditionally generous and unconditionally giving and connected with our oneness, that, I think, resonates with the youth. I think that resonates with everybody.
And does Charity Focus... Oh, go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, I just had a question. I don't know what the Sony TV story is.
So I met, at one point in the whole evolution of Charity Focus, I met a guy at a bar, of all things, and I don't drink, you know. And so we met at a bar at 11 p.m., and we had this conversation, and he was running... He had a foundation, and he was running an organization that... He was funding an organization that was a network of about 14,000 nonprofit organizations in South Asia. And so we met in India. He was from Singapore. I was living in the U.S. And we met, and, halfway through the call, halfway through our meeting, he says, you know, people like you should never have to, you know, worry about resources. What do you guys need? And I turn to him and say, I'd like you to volunteer. And he was really stunned by that. And he probably thought that I was a little crazy. We kind of kept in touch because we had good chemistry and we seemed, you know, we really got along. At the end of the year, he writes to me and he says, you know, Nipun, I'd like you to take all this on and do with it what you've done with Charity Focus. And so I told him, well, you know, there are a couple of things. First, you got to get everybody a job that's already employed in all the offices, because it would suck to be outsourced to, you know, by some volunteers. And so I said, you're going to do that? And he was in position to do that, so he did that. I said, then you got to volunteer. You got to sign up as a volunteer, and he did that. And so we take it on. And it's a thriving portal. We don't like the name at all, but it's one of those names. It's called propoor.org. But it's a really thriving portal of all kinds of nonprofit activity in South Asia. And that came about really because of our commitment to our values. I mean, I could have said, well, yeah, we need $25,000, you know, to do this or to do that, and here's my idea. And instead I said, look, we're just all about giving, and you should give too. It doesn't really matter who you are. And that yielded in such a deeper, rich friendship.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other questions?
How long ago was it that you did your pilgrimage in India, please?
It was in 2005. We were there most of the year. left at the end of January. So it was very recent. As I was sharing one or two of the stories, I mean, I was myself, you know, in that zone. I remember all that very freshly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Deepan, does Charity Focus accept donations?
We do.
Yes, okay.
But we don't ask.
But you don't ask.
Nipun, how is the Karma Kitchen going? Have you had 2 weeks now? Or?
Yeah. It's ridiculous. It's
really?
Been 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taken on this. We run the restaurant on Saturday nights, and it's completely on a gift economy basis. So you come in, have a meal, and the check says 00. Your meal has been paid for by a previous guest, and you're welcome to pay it forward as you wish. And people leave money, and that's how the whole thing goes. And it's a very, very amazing experience and series of experiences. The first night, and this is in Berkeley. I encourage all of you to come on down. If you go to karmakitchen.org, you can get the address. It's on Telegraph. But yeah, Saturday nights, it's awesome. The first night we were there, you know, I asked, I've been the maitre d' for the last couple of weeks just until all the pieces get organized, and then, you know, there will be many others that will take that on. And I go to one of the guests who's leaving. I go up to him and I said, you know, did you enjoy your meal? He said, oh, yeah, the meal was great, you know. And so I asked him, how would you describe your experience here to another friend? Because I have my ways of explaining the gift economy and trust and all of that. But I said, how would you explain it? And he said something that really moved me. You know, he says, it was an experience in receiving.
How wonderful.
He said, in our culture, we don't know how to receive because we always feel like we have to take from, you know. And when I came here and the meal just showed up, and it was an experience in receiving. And when you really learn how to experience that in a deep way, you have gratitude. And when you have gratitude, you inevitably pay it forward.
Mm-hmm.
Mission accomplished, I would say.
Nipun, we're right at the end of our time just about, but I want to warmly invite you to come visit us at Commonweal. I look forward to visiting you in Berkeley, and I just am so deeply inspired and touched, and just affected me very deeply to be in this kind of deep dialogue with you. So we all just have a great sense of gratitude for your work and for the engagement with you. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Michael. It was a real pleasure to be here, and I hope that we can all keep co-creating good things in the world.
I'm sure we will. Blessings to all. Thank you.
Blessings.
All, Barbara,
thank
Marian,
you, Michael,
thank you
and Nipun.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you
guys. So very much.
All right. We'll talk soon. Take care,
bye.
Guys.
Okay. Bye.